People have been talking recently, hopefully, about a ceasefire and maybe a truce. Instead, it looks like with a couple more blunders, we could be heading towards a World War III. It's a mess. And to learn where this might be going, I'm back talking today with my go-to guru on all things national security, Stephen Bryan, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. A couple of Stephen's recent columns headlines are, "Don't Expect a Ceasefire in Ukraine," "Is Ukraine President Zelensky's on the way out?" And this one, "Fire the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, now before it's too late." Sounds dire. So, Stephen, let's start wherever you want. Ceasefire or the head of NATO. Where do you want to launch into this? We've got a lot to cover.
We do. Well, the problem with the head of NATO is he's a warmonger. And the latest utterances was he gave permission, as if he has the right to give permission, to the Ukrainian to go and bomb Russian territory, Russian targets in Russia, with the new F-16s that they're supposed to get this by around June. It's reckless because, you know, the Russians will retaliate. They're not going to sit there and take it. And what's the purpose of it? It's not going to change the outcome of the fighting in Ukraine. It's just punitive operation aimed at Russia, which is a big part of what the Biden administration has been doing and promoting with long-range weapons, that sort of thing, for some months. It doesn't change the outcome in Ukraine. It only makes the Russians nastier and more aggravated with the West and with the United States in particular.
Who authorized him to say that?
My guess is that the White House did.
That's, we've talked in our previous shows about the wisdom of the team leading our policy there, Victoria Nuland and the rest of the crew. I this is warmongering of the highest order. We could get ourselves deep into, as I mentioned at the outset, this is World War III scenario.
Yeah. It's very risky. We've been playing chicken with the Russians for quite a while.
The war's been grinding on. Russia keeps making advances. Certainly Ukraine does not. Ukraine, as I think you pointed out, is on its third army and about out of that one. And there's nothing much
left. Got rid of that one now, too.
So they've got nobody left really to fight. Zelensky's become, of course, you wouldn't know because there are no polls in Ukraine, but I guess he's not beloved at this point. And it's clear that Ukraine doesn't have anything. And in the United States, Congress is unlikely to, except under a scenario that would be a bad scenario, contribute another $60 billion to this. So why now would Victoria Nuland order this provocative move? Is she trying to force Congress' hand? Does she want to see this thing escalate so that we're left with no choice but to put money in?
Well, remember, she's out as acting Deputy Secretary of State.
I didn't know that.
Yes, she's out. And so she, because she wasn't confirmable.
Okay.
That was the problem. They would have held up her confirmation forever. So they got Kirk Campbell to come in and take that job. So,
but she's still on the premises, isn't she?
Presumably, yes. But what her exact title is and what she's actually doing is not clear. The last official thing she did was about 2 weeks ago when she went to Ukraine to try and persuade Zelensky not to fire General Zaluzhny. That request was not honored by Zelensky. He fired Zaluzhny a few days after that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a White House policy,
well,
too.
Well, whether it's her or Jake Sullivan or...
Right,
or,
exactly.
It seems like they're trying to get Congress... It seems like they're trying to heat things up on purpose so that we're forced to go in with another $50, $60, $70 billion. Is that, you know, I'm not close enough, but does that seem like where this is?
Maybe. I'm not convinced that's the case, but I am convinced that what the first objective of the administration, the Biden administration, is to drag the war out as long as possible. He doesn't want Ukraine to collapse while he's running for president. I mean, it's real simple. It doesn't take rocket science. I mean, now, the real intent of the administration has been to get regime change in Moscow. You know, they focused entirely on that. And they used all our intelligence assets and the Ukrainians and anybody else they can tap into to try and knock off Putin or replace him or create a revolt inside Russia or whatever they want to do. All of it's based on premises that really don't hold much water. But that's what they've been trying to do. Whether they care about Ukraine per se, I doubt it. I think what they care about is threatening Moscow. That's the key.
Well, it seems like Putin's more firmly ensconced than ever. And
yeah, well, he is running for election, you know. So to speak. But he goes through the motions, you know. He tries to campaign. He just flew a Tupolev bomber, strategic bomber, flew in it for about 30 minutes or 40 minutes to show how macho he is.
I can only imagine. He had the flight jacket on and the scarf.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing, and the oxygen mask and
whole
nine yards. Yeah.
What do you make of his interview with Tucker?
2 hours and 8 minutes or something like that. It was very long.
We learned a lot of medieval Central European history.
Yeah, I mean, he filibustered the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I think it was useful because I think people should listen to what he says and his explanations. Whether you agree with them or not, it's your business, but I don't agree with them all. But I think that it's important to hear out what the Russians are saying. It's not the first thing. Well, it is the first where there's been a real interview with Putin. And now there's a TV program in the UK on ITV called Ukraine, The Other Side. Pretty gutsy because UK has been very pro-Ukraine, almost to the point of ridiculousness. And this is kind of shifting the balance back. So it's kind of interesting. I think the voices are starting to be heard that don't reflect the party line as it's been portrayed in our press. Even our press is starting to shift direction.
Did you notice that he seemed to be mirroring Tucker's body language? And then I read later on that that's an old KGB interrogation technique. And that's
well,
one
it's
of the ways,
debating tactic.
That's one of the ways you get people feeling comfortable as you mirror their body language.
I was a college debater. Until we were knocked off by a group of Catholic girls who decimated us. but I was always told, follow their hand motions and do the same thing. So I think it's the same point you're making.
Yeah. Well, it looked, you know, Tucker was striving to be relaxed.
And by the way, it didn't work.
I'm sure he was terrified. You go into the Kremlin and your imagination's got to catch fire, and then you sit with Putin, and I don't know, that's... He handled it pretty well, but I think he was working hard to look calm, and succeeded.
And in possession of his wits. I've been in the Kremlin a long time ago, and toured it. It's incredibly impressive. It's beautiful.
He said it looked more like the old executive office building here across the street from the White House.
Oh no, not at all.
Better.
Oh, much. It's gorgeous. I mean, it's got this incredible parquet flooring and beautiful carvings in the walls and paintings, and it's and the furniture looks very Scandinavian. So, and very beautiful too. So I suspect that the Scandinavian furniture guys came over and made it for him.
Interesting. Well, you know,
worth seeing.
Well, the thing about the Russia, you know, what happened with our sanctions, guess who is now buying almost half their oil from Russia is China. And instead of buying it at deeply discounted prices, I think they're paying a little above the world market price, because China's looking for that secure land-based supply of energy, which Russia can do. And I just learned that Russia now, 80% of the cars sold in Russia.
Chinese. Yeah. Well, the West won't send any there. I mean, the U.S. or the Europeans or the Japanese can't import cars anymore to Russia because of the sanctions.
See, this is the thing about the political class that I am just stunned by. They never anticipate the cleverness of the market and people's ability to get around a sanction or around some big edict. That people always adapt. And, you know, even with semiconductors, I think they're getting semiconductors, made in China, but through other suppliers. And they never anticipate the way people react. And it looks like all these bad things we're supposed to be doing to Russia have failed to do that.
Well, one of the vulnerabilities of the Russian defense industrial base, if you want to call it that, is the lack of microelectronics.
Mm-hmm.
They have a place called Zelenograd, which is north of Moscow, which was set up under the Soviets to try and produce semiconductors, and it does, but they're not at the same level of China, and they're certainly not the same level as Taiwan or the United States. Well, so Russians need to go out to get them.
Aren't they ripping semiconductors out of some of the consumer electronics they're buying and putting them into the Russian equipment? Or is that apocryphal?
That's nonsense. Okay. I mean, first of all, they have enough washing machines in Russia to do their job.
So we digress, but I enjoy digression. So we go to interesting places, but I think we've got to go back to something that is pretty stark, which is the idea of F-16s flying over Russia to hit targets inside Russia, flown by NATO pilots.
Yeah,
it strikes me that's war.
Oh, it is. By the way, the White House this week said that there weren't enough Ukrainian pilots to do the job. So, you know, they're only going to be about 30 F-16s. So if there are not enough Ukrainian pilots, that means they're mostly all dead, at least in my opinion.
So they're dead. We're bringing in NATO pilots. That's a declaration of war, essentially. And then I think you point out in your article that the F-16s are putting it mildly, late model F-16s, and they're old model. They're likely to be shot.
They're at least 20 years old.
Well, but... Okay, well...
Well, so is a lot of our stuff in our Air Force, so, you know, be careful. But these were European ones, Belgian, for example, Dutch, that were retired, essentially retired from service because they're moving on to things like the F-35 or things like the Eurofighter, you know, they're more modern airplanes. So I don't know what, you know, because no one has told us what modernization may have been done to get them ready for the Ukrainians. I have no idea. But even if you did it, they're still not superior aircraft compared to what the Russians have, like the Sukhoi 35, which is an agile, fabulous piece of equipment.
Well, I think
it's going to be difficult.
They're not survivable against Russian air defenses.
No,
and so we've got essentially a declaration of war, where it's nothing but a gesture, and I don't want to say I'm sympathetic to Putin, but if you look at from his perspective, they're looking. You know, we're now seeing mercenaries turning up dead from Poland, the United States. Wasn't there something like 60 French mercenaries killed recently? And so that's already
yes.
A NATO-ized effort, and we're trying to pretend this is Ukraine defending itself. It looks to me like very quickly, especially if Stoltenberg's got his way, we're going to end up a NATO versus Russia war.
Well, you know, there's an interesting thing here. What is a mercenary exactly? if his government sends former troops to Ukraine, are they mercenaries or are they insertions of troops by that NATO country? I'm more and more inclined to think they're not mercenaries. They're sent there on purpose to try and salvage the situation in Ukraine. Units of Romanians, units of Poles, units of French, some Brits, Americans, they wear national patches on their Ukrainian uniforms, so you know who they are. And a number of them were found dead after the fall of Avdiivka 2 weeks ago. So they were Poles mainly, and a couple of Americans. I'm not sure they're mercenaries. I think this is why we're tempting the fates, because when you do this sort of thing and the Russians say, hey, you know, you're involved in the war, you're making war on us, then the game's starting to change, isn't it?
Well, it seems like we're counting on Putin's forbearance.
Yeah, but how long?
Well, that's the big question.
I'm
hopeful to get an answer from you.
Well, I want to mention one thing in this connection. They keep erasing the point in the discourse that takes place in this country and elsewhere that Russia is a nuclear power. You know, you're playing with fire. It's a very dangerous thing because at some point the Russians could unleash. And you know, we don't want to create that kind of situation. What we really should want, we're not doing it, but what we should really want to do is try and find a solution to the Ukraine crisis and stabilize the situation in Europe so there's no war in Europe. That's what we should be doing, but we're not.
But we want to keep a war in Europe because that will help get Joe Biden elected, presumably. That's the thesis.
Well, at least in Ukraine, yeah. Keep the war in Ukraine going.
So
I don't think there's any doubt about that. There were plenty, you know, the U.S. has never participated in any peace process in Ukraine. Not in 2014, not in 2015, not this 2022 when there was tried. Not at all. In fact, the U.S. played the opposite role. If you listen to what former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett says, and he was trying to broker a deal, and he talked to Scholz and Germany and Macron and France, and finally to Biden people in Washington. The Biden people told him, forget it, we're not going along with it. And he reports that quite candidly. So they have not wanted a peace process. They've been against it. And so is Zelensky, of course, but he's doing what he's told.
So where's Zelensky end up? Where's Zelensky going to be 3 months from now?
What? The south of France? Maybe.
Has he already got his place?
I don't see him surviving politically. I'm not speaking physically, but politically. Someone has to bear responsibility for all the losses that the Ukrainians have suffered.
What do you think that number is now?
I'm guessing, it's only a guess, somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000.
That's stunning.
Yeah.
The
Russians have lost a lot too, but we don't know the Russian numbers because they're very hard to come by. By the way, Ukrainian ones are too. But you can figure it out. And, you know, people have surveyed the burial grounds, the new burial grounds for the troops and all that, to try and come up with a number. Of course, that doesn't tell you how many were wounded and survived.
Those are deaths. Those are not casualties. Those are deaths. You've got so many casualties beyond that.
The general attitude in Ukraine now, you know, they've come up with this idea of recruiting people up to the age of 60 into the army. And they're pulling people off the streets and out of health clubs and out of nightclubs and out of restaurants, out of their apartments. I mean, it's really rough. They're not volunteering. But I think the key is they all have the same point of view, and they say it out loud, and their families say it. they're going to be thrown into the front with no training, and they're just going to be killed. That's it. That's the outlook of the Ukrainian men being pulled into the army now. It's very grim, very grim.
So Sebastian Gorka, who is very, I guess, I don't know quite how to describe him. He says, send Ukraine what they need. Send ammunition. Send them Soviet equipment sitting unused in former Warsaw Pact states, and use America's peerless intelligence to end the war and reestablish their national sovereignty. Now, this column was written yesterday.
Really?
Gorka worked in the White House. He should know better to know what the situation on the ground is. And I think it's just reckless for us to start acting like if we throw more money and just try a little harder that we're going to turn this thing around. I don't see it getting turned around.
Exactly. Look, the first problem is manpower, not ammunition. The number one problem facing Ukraine is manpower. The second number two problem is morale, which is very bad. The number three problem is ammunition. You know, they're short, especially artillery. But we can't replace that because we don't make it. Not enough of it to replace at the level that they would need. But, you know, right now the Russians have air superiority over the battlefield. That's a big deal. So they heavily bomb Ukrainian positions relentlessly. Secondly, they have lots of artillery, and they have lots of missiles, and they have a lot of troops. They can add to any day in the week. They have more troops trained and ready to go in. Basically, I think the Russians have been fairly cautious in their approach, taking it one step at a time. They have not tried to break through or do anything big yet. They could. There's a lot of talk about another Russian offensive coming. But, you know, it's that kind of difficult situation that Ukraine is in. I don't understand Gorka's outlook. By the way, if you want to talk about U.S. intelligence, the New York Times on Sunday this past week reported that the U.S. has 12 major intelligence stations along the Russian border in Ukraine, and is assisting the Ukrainians not only to spy on the Russians, that's a given, but also to support their operations to carry out assassinations and attacks inside Russia and inside the Donbass and down in Zaporizhzhia and Kherson, places like that, Crimea too. They have two units that are dedicated to that, supported by the CIA. One's called Unit 2245, and the other one's called the Fifth Directorate. That's more the assassination side. Now, none of this is going to stop the Russians. Okay? None of it. All it's going to do is make the Russians more furious, more angry, and more difficult. So I don't see the benefit of this at all, but somebody in Washington does, because their objective is regime change. Still.
Well, as you point out, the regime change is going to be Zelensky. It's not going to be Putin.
I think so. I don't see how, you know, after, you know, he did two major blunders. First one was Bakhmut, the city of Bakhmut in the Donetsk area. And that was a hell of a battle, a long battle. But at the end of the day, the Ukrainians were thrown out. Had tremendous losses on both sides. The second one was Avdiivka, which is very close to Donetsk city, the capital of the Donbass. And the Russians won that one too. But in both those cases, Zelensky said, we stay to the bitter end. We're not going to retreat. We're going to win. We're going to roll the Russians back. We're going to do blah, blah. He even went to Avdiivka and got his picture. He made a selfie standing at the city gates.
Here I am. Yeah.
But they lost. And the casualty rates were very high. And it was a rout. Finally, they ran out, and the Ukrainian troops and the so-called mercenaries, they ran out in a chaotic way. It wasn't a measured retreat. These blunders.
Who takes out Luzinski? Do we take him out?
Zelensky? No, yeah. I don't think that. I think it has to be the will of the Ukrainian people, basically.
Well, we've never really concerned ourselves with the will of the Ukrainian people. I mean, how many times have we engineered regime change there?
Oh, we did. No.
So,
I suppose that was the will. But this was, you know, he was an elected. He's an elected president.
So this is a mess. This is a real mess. I don't think we've got anybody smart or strategic in our administration remotely interested in. I mean, it's just disgusting when you talk about the number of Ukrainians who've been killed. And that's just the deaths, the casualties, and the lack of hospitals,
and the destruction of the country.
Yeah, it's
a lot of destruction.
And no grown-ups. The Brits are hawks on this. The Poles are hawks. The head of NATO is a hawk. They want to just plunge ahead.
And the Germans are hawkish too. But the German government is not in very good shape these days.
Well, what's their approval rating there? 15%?
That's very low.
It's only higher than Macron's. What's he at, 11 or something in France?
Yeah, no, it's higher than Macron's, but it's still in the low 20s. Those governments are really overextended into things that they, you know. Let's talk about Germany for a minute. Germany should be a powerful state. It has all the money it needs, but its army is a mess. It has a very small army. Its equipment is a wreck. It couldn't fight its way out of a paper bag if it tried. And these are the guys pushing for war in Ukraine. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, the climate change agenda has been has caused them to unilaterally disarm on the manufacturing front. You know, the chemicals industry, I think their industrial production is down 4 or 5%. In the last 12 months, maybe in the last 6 months, and it's not going up, it continues to go down. And that's self-inflicted.
Yeah, but they're also not meeting their 2% that they claim they should meet for NATO. I mean, they're not doing that. And a lot of the equipment they say they have and they're supporting is not being supported, missing spare parts. It's in rough shape. And by the way, the Brits are no better off. The British can't even get their two aircraft carriers to the Red Sea to fight the Houthis. And they're talking about winning in Ukraine. Come on, give me a break. They're in sad condition. The British Army is smaller than the army they sent over to the United States in 1774. I mean, it's smaller. So, I mean, who's kidding who here?
So,
I mean,
as usual,
we should be wanting to rebuild NATO. I think Trump's right about that.
Well,
we should be wanting to rebuild NATO properly and not try and invite conflict. I think that you always get sometimes what you wish for.
So barring the new administration coming in 10 months, something like that, barring, you know, if Trump wins, it would be very different. But if Trump doesn't win, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I don't see the war lasting until next January.
Okay, what happens after the election?
No, I mean, before the election. I mean, I think I'm talking about Ukraine.
Right.
I don't think Ukraine can, the current government of Ukraine can't last that long. In my opinion, based on my experience, you know, I've been in Vietnam and in Cambodia and Laos when they were falling apart, and I've seen governments fall apart. I know what it's like. This government can't possibly have much public support left, if any. And I think the Ukrainians are tired of the war. Most importantly, the army is tired of the war, the real army. And yeah, there's a few thugs that they use to recruit hapless kids off the street. And there's thugs they can use, like the Azov Brigade. It's called the 3rd Brigade now, which are made up of fanatical nationalist types. But they're too small. They can't hold on to the country, I don't think. So I think that we're going to see the end soon.
So what does Ukraine look like 6 months from now? You mentioned early, I think their objectives were just to consolidate Russia to consolidate some of the land they've taken and get assurances that NATO is going to drop its desire to get into NATO. But now it looks like there's going to be a much more total takeover of Ukraine by Russia. A lot of it
depends on timing.
Yeah.
If for example, there was regime change in Kiev tomorrow morning, if, for example, and assuming that the regime change was a new regime that wanted to make a deal with the Russians and was willing to drop the NATO stuff and all that and just end it, that's one scenario that you could happen. What we don't really know is who will be next in terms of leadership, nor the Russians don't know either. I'm sure they're trying to influence that. My best guess is Zelensky.
Because
Zelensky was the commander-in-chief of all the armed forces of Ukraine until Zelensky fired him a few weeks ago. And I think, the Russians respect Zelensky to a certain extent. They certainly respect him as a professional. And he might be the guy. I don't think a Ukrainian politician living in Ukraine today is in a position. There's some candidates, Poroshenko, for example, the mayor of Kiev's another one, who could, lead a kind of revolt and replace Zelensky. But I don't think it's going to come from there. It's going to come from the army. This is my guess. Well,
if he comes from the army, it seems like you immediately want to sue for peace, but that's not exactly the way a military guy might think. Or might, I don't know. So we get a new leader. What's the first day one thing he does?
He opens a channel to the Russians.
Okay, so that's where the settlement comes from.
He said, "Look, I want to have a conversation with you. I want to end the war. We should find ways to live together. We have lived together in the past for hundreds of years. Zelensky is this pretty smart fellow. It's not that he's pro-Russian. He's not at all.
I'm always trying to wind my way towards a conclusion where I see a line of action, we get an outcome.
I wish there was an easy one.
It's a problem for me. Geopolitical stuff doesn't lend itself to a crisp solution.
Well, I mean,
it sounds like what we ought to be hoping for is that regime change, is a pragmatic military leader looking at the military situation saying, look, we can't fight this anymore. He talks to the Russians, they cut a deal, the thing shuts down, and that leaves Poland and Stoltenberg and Britain holding the bag. And it sounds to me like they should be holding the bag.
Whether they should or shouldn't be, they will be. That would be the outcome. I mean, Poland has legitimate security interests. I think one part of a deal would be that Western Ukraine becomes a buffer zone to help shield Poland and also Lithuania and to try and calm the situation. The Russians could also pull their nuclear weapons out of Belarus, which would be a big help. There's things that can be done to make this reasonable. But the U.S. is disengaged from that. We're not actually promoting any solution like that. So it's very foolish of us, actually. Yeah. Incidentally, Western Ukraine is quite different than the rest of Ukraine religiously. It's more Roman Catholic than Orthodox. And it has some other minorities like Hungarians, a lot of those. And Poland used to have a claim on it. Lviv was a Polish city at one time.
So in effect, Western Ukraine is absorbed into Poland.
I wouldn't say absorbed. I'd say a buffer zone.
All right, buffer
zone. Some kind of guarantee, no military troops there. Okay. That kind of thing. Buffer zone is different than absorbed.
Okay,
absorbed means it's annexed somehow.
Well, yeah, that's not going to happen. But, okay, well, I'm always left sputtering by the time you and I talk.
I don't want to make you sputter.
Well, that's all right. It's good for me. It's good exercise.
I think we have to think geopolitically, you know.
Yeah.
We have to think about how to protect Europe, how to calm the Russians down so they don't do these things again. There are a lot of interests that we have. How to remove as much as possible nuclear weapons from both sides in the conflict area so that they're not part of the... And we've done it before. We did it with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement, which we canceled, by the way. It was the U.S. that canceled it, not the Russians. Then the Russians canceled it. And we said, well, the Russians cheated. But instead of trying to fix it, we canceled it.
Yeah,
they probably did cheat, by the way. I don't doubt it for a minute. But that wasn't the right outcome.
Well, Stephen, we've got to wrap it up. Let's get back and talk in 6 weeks or so to see how this develops. You're now writing on Substack, and you've got we call it Weapons, and it's a great name.
Weapons and Strategy.
Weapons and Strategy. I highly recommend everybody get on Substack and subscribe to Stephen. He puts out a very interesting analysis rooted in his background. What was your title? Yoda of the arms trade for the Pentagon.
Yeah, I didn't come up with that title.
Well, but still, it's a good one. It's a good one. You ought to, you don't have to. It's an appropriate one because you actually know how this stuff actually works on the ground, which is very helpful. So I really highly recommend that everybody listening to this read Stephen and, of course, watch this show when Stephen comes back on with some good news. About Ukraine
the good news will come when the war ends.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll be talking before then, sounds like. So Stephen, thank you as always, endlessly interesting. And hope you all enjoyed this. You can find our show, The Bill Walton Show, on all the major podcast platforms. We're also on Substack. We're on CPAC Now website. If you're not already a subscriber, please subscribe and urge your friends to, and send us a note and tell us other shows you'd like us to be covering, and we will work to do just that. So anyway, thanks for joining, Stephen.
Thank you very much.